Fan Junkies Radio is brought to you by FanJunkies.net, where sports meet social networking. That's right. It's still NASCAR week here on Fan Junkies Radio. Thank you for all for tuning in. I'm your host, Jonathan Ragus. Alongside me is the great Mike McShane. Mike, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan. How are we doing? Boy, oh, boy. A lot of fun, tell you. A lot of fun. We got some great stuff planned. We got wonderful announcements coming.
Yeah.
Good stuff. And NASCAR week continues on.
Absolutely, man. You and I have been working on a lot of guests, and we have even...
Yep.
More theme weeks coming out here, going in stride here with our NASCAR week on Fan Junkies Radio, which has been great. On Monday, we had Sean Corr from Empire Racing, and joining us today is Steve Nelson from Freescale Semiconductor. And if you don't know what Freescale Semiconductor is, well, then you're like me. No. And we're going to find out, and that's why we have Steve Nelson here. Mike knows, because Mike's a big NASCAR fan.
Yeah.
I'm not. So we're going to have Steve talk about what Freescale Semiconductor is, and its link to NASCAR, as well as a lot of the logistics to the cars, fuel injection systems, and some cool stuff, man. So
Even
if you just like cars, this is definitely a show for you. So
Absolutely.
But before we do anything, we have an announcement. Mike and I finally got a hat trick in our hat trick challenge. Can you believe it, folks? Can you believe it? We're actually and the funny part is we got two in a row, back to back. We only count the one because it was on radio show day. So
on Monday, We should have had a drum roll for that big announcement there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, funny part is we both got 6 for 6 in 2 days, and then yesterday, what did I do? I went 0 for 3.
I went 2 for 1 yesterday, or 2 and 1.
Well, You're a classy guy, Mike McShane.
That's right.
Okay, so let's throw it out here right now. If anybody doesn't know about it, it's called the Hat Trick Challenge presented by Enterprise. You can join our league, Fan Junkies Radio, over at hattrick.nhl.com. You're asked 3 questions every day, and if you get every question right, you get a hat trick. And then whoever has the most hat tricks by the end of the season wins. It's that simple. It's a lot of fun. It takes 2 seconds to do.
Yep.
So I'm going to throw these questions out to you, Mr. McShane. You give me your answer, and then I'll give you mine.
Okay.
Will James Neal of the Pittsburgh Penguins score at least one goal against your Philadelphia Flyers?
I got to tell you, today's questions to me were really, really difficult.
Yeah.
You know, I could either go 0 for 3 or 3 for 0 just as easily. Neal's had a tremendous, tremendous couple of games here going in early on in this season. But I am answering no.
Well, of course you are. It's against your Flyers.
My Flyers defense is going to shut him down.
And I'm going yes, because I'm a Rangers fan, and I really don't care about the Flyers. And I could care less about the Penguins as well.
I think Neal's got, 11 goals in 15, 16 games?
Yeah, 11 goals, 3 assists. He's 14 points on the season right now.
Yeah, and see, I'll tell you why I'm saying no. Because I do think that while the Flyers defense has been somewhat suspect, I think they are going to key on him.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, great.
And that's why I'm saying no.
Okay. Which team will win between the Los Angeles Kings and the Calgary Flames?
You know that Vegas scratched this line on this game completely. It started out as a puck and a half favorite for the Kings, and then they just took it off the board completely. Right now, this is a toss-em game. I'm going to go with Calgary.
I'm going with L.A. here. So right away, we both got different answers. So third question now, which team will win between the St. Louis Blues and the Colorado Avalanche?
This is the Blues are on the road, and they took a tough loss last night. I'm kind of hoping that they're going to rebound because I'm taking the Blues.
I'm taking the Blues as well, and the Blues have been picked by 73% of hat trick competition fans, Mike.
That's irrelevant.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. It's the expert pick you have to worry about. All right, man, let's stay with the
expert pick. Is that yours and mine?
No, it's real experts. All right, let's stay with the NHL trend here real quick before we're joined by Steve Nelson and get it to NASCAR.
I got one for you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I got one for you real quick. Just for the fun of it, 42 years ago today, 1971, since we're sticking with NHL.
That's when you turned
16? No.
Oh.
Phil Esposito of the Boston Bruins, he became the quickest NHL player to reach 50 goals in a season 42 years ago today in 1971.
Very, very nice. Very nice.
There you go. So I kept it timely.
Yes, you did. And you kept it NHL. So.
Yes, right.
All right, real quick. Blackhawks have matched the record for opening point streak with their win over the Atlanta – who was that? The Vancouver Canucks 4-3 in a shootout last night.
Mm-hmm.
16 straight games now with at least 1 point.
Mm-hmm.
Their record, I believe, is now 13-0-3, Mike.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Absolutely incredible. And, you know, what a tremendous way, really, when it comes right down to it. If you're going to break the record, do it dramatically, and that's what the Hawks did, 4-3 in a shootout.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, I mean, that's the way to do it.
Put it this way, too. I mean, Joel Quenneville, head coach of the Blackhawks, his comments as well, he seems kind of surprised by it. He says, it's a remarkable start. We're very happy and pleased. Guys should be proud of the achievement and where they are at, especially in a 48-game season. It's put us in a real, real good spot.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And you know what? It has.
Absolutely.
It has put them in a real, real good spot, as I believe Chicago is 29 points in the Central. They are 8 points over the Nashville Predators, who are having a good season as well. So.
Yeah, well, you beat me to the punch. I was just trying to get the numbers up, and my Internet Explorer browser just crashed. So. Yeah.
The horse named McGraw.
Yeah, 20, you're right, 8 points ahead of Nashville. You know, and Nashville's having a good start to their season. You know, kind of reminds me of the Denver Nuggets over there, right? If Denver was in a different division altogether, they'd be leading their division. Nashville as well, playing very, very well. And yet you got Chicago up at the top there with no losses.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, if Nashville was in the, let's see if they were, in the Northwest or they were in the Southeast, they would be in first place.
Yep.
So, I mean, they're having a very, very good season. The West is looking very, very good. So, real quick, let's go through the standings here. Pittsburgh and New Jersey tied in the Atlantic, 22 points apiece. Montreal, 23 points. They got a win over the Rangers last night. Puts them over Boston Bruins. They're 3 points up on them. Boston, Toronto, Ottawa, all three are tied with 20 points, Mike, there in the Northeast.
Look at that division. I mean, could that get any closer, any tighter? You know, boy, that's amazing. Jonathan, looking at that real quick at this point right now, where do you think that division's going to end up in the end?
The Northeast?
Yeah.
Wow. You know what? You can never discount Boston, Mike. Montreal on a 5-game win streak. They're playing very, very good hockey. It's slow paced. It's boring hockey, but they're taking teams off their game, which is a win.
Yeah.
I don't see Ottawa continuing. I think Buffalo will play a little bit better towards the end of the season. Toronto. Who knows? You know what? 10-7-0 for Toronto. A little shocked about that, but I, you know what? I see it coming down between Montreal and Boston. So
Boston's got 3 games in hand on Montreal and 4 games in hand on the rest of the league.
Yeah.
The rest of the division.
Yep.
So, I mean, they've only played 13 games versus 16 and 17 for the others.
Absolutely. So.
So that's probably going to – you're right. I mean, if you look at the trend, you would have to think that Boston probably has the edge.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because they're going to have more games to play.
Exactly.
And they can come up on them real quick. So.
Yep.
In the Southeast, Carolina, Tampa Bay tied at first, 17 points apiece. In the West, as we said, Chicago, 29 points, 8 points over Nashville for first place in the Central. Vancouver Canucks, 20 points, first place in the Northwest. And in the Pacific, Anaheim, 25 points, Mike, 12-2-1 record.
I've been waiting for Anaheim to stumble, and they're just not doing it.
No, they're also on a 5-game win streak, just like Montreal.
Exactly. I really thought San Jose was going to kind of dominate that division there. When Anaheim took it over a couple of weeks ago, I actually, you know, I guess prematurely said, wait, hold on. Anaheim will be down shortly. And no, they haven't been. They haven't relinquished the lead.
Yeah. I mean, look at San Jose, though, too, man. They were just unstoppable in the beginning of the season.
That's my point, yeah.
You know, now they're 6 points out of first place all of a sudden.
I know.
I just can't believe that because they were playing. I mean, Patrick Marleau was just on fire. And honestly, what has Patrick Marleau did since then?
Exactly. He has really, really cooled off.
Yeah, 10 goals, 6 assists. I believe his last goal was on February 11th against Columbus. Before that, January 27th against Vancouver.
Yeah.
So, wow.
Yep.
Was that age catching up to him or what?
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't say, you know, I don't know. I don't know. It's just streaky, you know. Sometimes there's just no other way to describe it except to say that, you know, a particular player is streaky, you know. So that's all I can think of.
That's always something I tell the people where, you know, Rangers fans are ripping into Rick Nash over not scoring goals. Look at it this way. As fast as Patrick Marleau got to 10 goals in the beginning of the season, that can just click on tomorrow night for Rick Nash and he can score 10 goals, you know, so it can happen at any time. So
exactly. I mean, look, we see it in every single team, particularly I think you see it more so in hockey. I think it's more susceptible in hockey. I mean, we you know, all of a sudden we could have somebody over here in Philadelphia like Danny Briere go on a streak and he'll be scoring, you know, out of his mind for like a week and a half.
No, absolutely. It's happened before, and I'm sure we'll see it happen again, Mike.
Absolutely.
Real quick, before we get to our guest, Steve Nelson from Freescale Semiconductor, we're putting together an NHL week here, Mike.
Yeah, we are. And the response to it, Jonathan, has just been a tad bit overwhelming.
Absolutely.
I spent a good 30 minutes or more just this morning trying to work it all out and figure out what we have.
Yeah, there'll be certain shows in our NHL week that we might even have to go a full 2 hours and have anywhere as up to three guests. So
yep.
It's going good. We're talking to a lot of former players, some former referees, some known names. We're really excited about it. It's going to be between March 11th and March 15th, that Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we're going to have guests. But we have so many that we might even have guests the Friday before and the Monday after NHL-wise. So if you're an NHL fan, definitely going to be something for you. So
yeah, we may have to do that, Jonathan, because there's just like I said, the response has just been incredible.
Yeah, and I know Sidekick is going to be happy about our NHL week.
You got to know that he's going to be tuning in. He's going to want to call in for those.
Oh, I'm sure he will. You know what? I'm sure he's so excited right now. He's pacing back and forth at work. So. Oh, man. All right. Let's get to our guest here. I believe this is him on the line with us. Right now, we should be joined by Steven Nelson of Freescale Semiconductor. Steve, is that you?
Yeah. Good morning. You guys there?
Yep.
Yeah, we're here, man. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hey, you bet. Greetings from, beautiful Austin, Texas this morning.
Lucky man. It's very cold here in the Northeast, so.
Well, soon to be by late tonight at Daytona Speedway as well, so.
You're heading down there. You're heading down there shortly, right, Steve?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll be there tonight, and you know, we're ready to certainly see all the cars start running by tomorrow evening as well. Absolutely.
There you go.
Very nice. All right, Steve. Well, you know, right off the bat, for our listeners who aren't into racing, who aren't into NASCAR, and who don't know Freescale Semiconductor, can you tell us a little bit about Freescale and your link to NASCAR?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's not a surprise that, you know, Freescale isn't exactly what I would call a household name right now. And if you're in certain industries, you know, we are real familiar. Where people certainly know Freescale is when we were part of Motorola, everybody certainly knows Motorola. And so we were the electronics division of Motorola that was spun off a number of years ago. And really our role in not just racing but automotive electronics in general goes back literally decades. If you go back to the, I think we've traced it back to the 1980 Cadillac Eldorado, which was the first electronic fuel-injected car.
Wow.
And as they say, kind of the rest is history. And so our role in automotive electronics today spans really everything that the consumer sees, everything from Ford Sync, you know, to advanced safety systems and airbags and powertrain. I think I read an analyst recently talking about his car, and he said, well, I think what it is just a bunch of electronics, but it happens to have an engine and some wheels to push it all around. And, you know, that is not far from the truth. So, you know, when NASCAR contacted us, better part of 4 years ago now, several years before the launch, about moving to fuel injection, they were certainly looking for a partner that not only had the history, but the quality, reliability, and everything to make a change like this, which, as we all know, was really the most significant change in the engine platform in literally decades. So,
right. The you're heading down there to Daytona, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just jump out on kind of a cosmetic issue. We're taking a look at, for the first time this season, the brand new Gen 6 models.
Yes.
The you probably sat and watched, as I did, the Sprint Unlimited the other night.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of buzz about the fact this was going to be the first time we were going to see all of these new cars, you know, in real competition on the track. What's your – how would you – and this is a snowball question. I'm throwing it out there that way on purpose.
Okay.
But – and then I'm going to get to the tough ones. Then I'm going to get – so I'm just warning you right now.
Okay.
Give me your assessment of the new models that we have right now on the track. This is the first time, I believe, since I think it's 2007, since the Car of the Future was introduced. What's your assessment of the look of these new cars?
Well, you know, the thing that I see, and I think the fans will notice as well, is when you see them out running on the track, just cosmetically, the number one thing that I can tell is you can really see where the Fords and where the Chevys and where the Toyotas are running. I mean, they physically look different. You know, you can pick up those grills on those Fords. You know, you can see when they're out there. You can really see the physical difference, right? So I think, number one, everybody's real excited about the work that NASCAR and that the OEMs all put into making this car look like, and, you know, bringing that stock back to stock car racing. And let me comment on that point, because this is something where, you know, when you get back to our electronics, right, something that's important about those engine control units, and if you walk up and, you know, you have the opportunity to go up to those cup cars, every one of them, and you can see it obviously from the in-dash cameras, you'll see that little red box sitting right up there on the dash. It has two big cables plugged into it, and if you got close enough, you would see that it has a McLaren and Freescale logo on it, and that's the engine control unit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we really were the first step in NASCAR saying, you know, we're putting the stock back into stock cars, because the electronics that we sell to McLaren, who makes that engine control box that sits right there on that dash, those are the exact same devices that we sell to passenger cars.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do special testing. We don't do special screening. You know, they buy the ones right off the line that go out into production cars.
Mm-hmm.
So when we take, you know, I mean, literally the electronics that are running the cars on the track are out in the parking lot bringing the fans to the track. So, you know, the whole trend of starting to bring some of that stock back really started with fuel injection. Now, you know, it's a multi-point system. It's not a direct injection or some of the newer technologies, and there was reasons NASCAR went that way. But, you know, so to get back to your question, you know, what about the Gen 6 car? You know, I love it. I think they look great. I think everybody thinks they look great. You know, the safety issues and the reason they went to the car tomorrow, you know, everybody understands why they did that. But the work that's gone into these new cars, I think everybody is really excited about it. I think they look great.
Yeah, absolutely. The word that was being used the other night consistently was sexy, and that they are. I mean, they're just really great looking.
Well, exactly.
And it's wonderful to hear that so many drivers are accepting of it, because one of the things that I think auto drivers are notorious for is kicking and screaming with anything new. We saw it 7 years ago when they introduced the Car of the Future. Last year, now, let's get into the whole electronic fuel injection system. NASCAR moved to it. You guys implemented it. There was a lot of controversy around it.
Yeah.
There were issues with it. We saw some things, particularly early on in the NASCAR season last year, where there were some failures that were blamed on it.
Right.
Address some of those things, Steve.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you put a system like this into a car, and you can actually go back and look at really any of the changes that come into racing, right? When they went from from the new ignition systems, right? As they went, you know, a number of years ago, you talked to the guys at NASCAR, and they said, you know, they had huge failure rates with those. Well, number one, what racing does is it obviously tests your equipment, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
Spark plugs break, heck, lug nuts, you know, break, tires blow. This is, as we know, that's what makes racing exciting. As you get towards the end, what's going to happen?
Right.
You know, we can go to the end of the chase last year and look what happened to, you know, the 48 car blowing a tire,
yep.
Right? And that kind of thing, right? That's the nature of what we do. So when you put a system, and when you talk to Hendrick guys, and you talk to the Roush Yates, you know, engines and the different Toyota Racing, and you talk to them about their engine development, they know that, number one, they're bringing in a system that they have familiarity. Obviously, they use fuel injection in a lot of race series. They just happen to not be using it in NASCAR. So it wasn't like a bunch of stuff showed up that they didn't know what to do with. Right. So number one, they had some familiarity. So when you put a and when you talk to those guys, they all said the same thing. They knew that, and we had proven it. This system that we supply via McLaren is an established system. This wasn't a brand new, built from scratch fuel injection system. Right. This was a piece of technology that had been proven as reliable. So they knew that they were getting a good system. But there's a couple of things that the teams, you know, have to deal with. Number one is you're putting other things on the car. You're putting some sensors, right, which is kind of, again, we can talk about some of the issues that they had. You know, you're putting some new wires. You're putting new things into the race environment. And so what is going to happen? What is going to break? What are the unexpected consequences? So I think a couple of things. So number one is the teams had to go through a learning process. What NASCAR did, and one of the reasons it took a little bit longer for this transition is they had to define what I call the sandbox. Think of it as parental controls. What parameters in what ranges is NASCAR going to allow the teams to operate and to tune their cars? That, you know, setting that up actually took quite a bit of time. What,
right.
You know, what areas are they going to? So once you have that, the teams then, where do you find speed? How do you win? You look for it in the corners. How are they going to operate within those parameters to make, you know, to find speed and certainly to be competitive and win? The other thing was, and we saw this at Phoenix, right, mm-hmm. when Tony Stewart,
Tony, right,
car wouldn't restart, right, and everybody's looking at this. We're like, hey, we got out of Daytona, no problems. Now here we are, and it couldn't be somebody less visible than the number 14, but, you know, there it is, right?
And the finger was pointed directly at you guys.
And they were pointing right at the box. Well, and so, you know, that situation, what you know, as the teams obviously went back and to figure out what happened, you know, what you found early in the season is, I'll just say that the teams were, I mean, to an extent, they were kind of trying to outsmart themselves as well. Seeing the way the system worked, understanding how different things are set, how the engine will restart in certain scenarios, they just didn't have the experience. Plus, when he comes, you know, you see him here, he comes onto pit row, well, you know, the guys are going over the wall, they're just kind of standing there looking at the car. They don't really know what to do. They didn't know, okay, look, here's your checklist, right? You're going to reach up, there's a relay, which is more or less like an electrical breaker box. It sits right next to the engine control. There's two buttons on it. What had happened was one of those had vibed through vibration had released. Well, nobody's looking at that. If they'd have hit that button, it would have started immediately. If Tony would have hit it in the car, mm-hmm. it would have restarted. So there's the point of that whole discussion is early in the season, you know, a little bit of issue like a fuel, you know, what about the fuel pickup? Are we getting enough? You know, things around the computer itself, how is the whole system operating, and the teams learning through that. So if you think about, you're right, we had Tony and we had Brad with a little bit of a problem here or there.
Right.
But as you got kind of into April and May,
right.
You know, and we knew this. We said, you know, we really want to be the story. This is a great story for NASCAR. It's a great story for the OEMs. But if we're the story in May, it, you know, I don't want my phone ringing because it is not a good story. It means a problem, you know. So, you know, I think what you saw is when you got towards April and May,
you're right.
a lot of that started to back off. And I'll tell you, I think the second part of that story is when you think about the early season issues. But the thing about the computer in the car is that it literally has changed the sport. And we talk about this as we talk about the Gen 6 car, literally forever. And what I mean by that is when you think about, and I was driving from Austin up to Dallas for the night race in Texas back in the fall, and I was listening to Greg Biffle. He had qualified the day before, and they were replaying some of his comments. And Greg said, you know, I did this really great qualifying lap, and I'm not really sure why. I can't wait to get back to the hauler so that I can look at the throttle and braking
yeah.
traces and figure out what right. I'm doing. And that's the part of it that I don't think the teams, the drivers, and everybody really saw is, you know, their ability and how the drivers interact with the teams and the crew chiefs, the information that they have, which, let's be clear, is nothing compared to what you get in other racing series, but it's critical information.
Yeah, that's one of the
part.
Things, that's one of the things you had brought up to me in a previous conversation was all of the information that was coming out of this, the data that was now available to the drivers and their teams, which they previously did not have. And there was a lot of praise, as you point out, Steve, there was a lot of praise from teams. You heard it publicly by about May and April and May. It's about when you started hearing this, that they were amazed at how much information they were getting.
Exactly. When you hear about, you know, people talking with Tony Stewart, you know, gosh, how is his restarts are awesome.
Yeah.
You know, how does he do that? Well, you know what? The team knows a lot more about how. Now, that definitely doesn't mean he's going to share that information
right.
with anybody, but they know that information. Throttle and braking are two of the parameters that they get, the teams get, and they're able to look at that off of the engine computer and really look at that information. You know, if you've ever been around one of these cup cars when they have an open test, like when we started showing up in the garage at Charlotte in Kentucky when they had some of the first fuel injection tests, when you see this, the amount of equipment that those teams pile into those cars, sensors and data loggers, and it's surprising actually that there's room for the driver. Seems like at a point maybe they'll forget that a guy has to drive the car. But that is their opportunity to collect data that then they do not have the opportunity, obviously, during normal race times. So information, as we know, I mean, look at the margin of victory. You're talking car lengths after 500 miles. How do teams win? Well, it's those very small, I always call it the corners. They're looking for those details. And this computer now is a new entity that they look at that gives them that kind of information that, again, they just didn't have before. Now, again, I don't think we're going down a road like Formula One where you have real-time telemetry and
right.
you got a crew of people literally around the world that are managing that car on the track.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly, again, you think about, let's go back to the stock, let's talk about Gen 6 car, that stock in the stock car. I mean, we all know, you know, the things that you can do in your car today. This is a little bit of a step. This is a mm-hmm. first step of NASCAR, you know, in getting – and let's be honest, right? We did not have – again, we certainly – there were some issues around some certain things in the system, but if you look at the computer itself, the most complicated thing in the car, literally, we did not have a single engine computer fail during any competition last year.
Right.
So when guys would pull – you know, you'd see they'd pull in – and it happened several times. They're having a problem. They've lost a cylinder. They've done this. You know, it's pretty easy. Two connectors, they can pop that computer off, and they put another one on. Well, guess what?
Mm-hmm.
Problem's still there.
Well,
so they know it wasn't the computer.
It's the beginning of a new season. I think I heard you knock on wood over there, didn't I?
Let's see if there's a wholesale failure on Sunday. My replacement that you guys will be talking to next week may have a different story for you.
Steve, real quick, this is a question that would probably be better answered by a NASCAR official, but let me throw it at you. Perhaps maybe you've got an answer for it. I would think that some of our folks that are listening, particularly folks perhaps maybe who are just getting into NASCAR, maybe they're a little bit novice to it. You made the comment that electronic fuel injection has been around since 1980 with the Cadillac.
Mm-hmm.
Why in the world did it take till 2012 for NASCAR to get into it?
You know, that's certainly a question that everybody discussed, especially a couple of years ago. And I think the way that I would address it, and that I do even, you know, within, you know, because I deal with obviously a very technical and engineering-oriented audience in what we do. And the way that I explain it is, I mean, NASCAR is entertainment. It is a sport. Carburetors, although well-known and in, I guess, let's say, only in the worlds of lawn maintenance and things now, if you think about where carburetors exist,
right.
It is reliable, and it was fairly well understood, and they had a good product on the track. What do you want? You want good, tight, hard racing, and although it was certainly an old mechanical piece, it didn't – hey, if you can generate 850, 900 horsepower, why would you change? You're putting a product on the track, and I think – though NASCAR reached a point where they also realized, yeah, it's a good product, but again, we've lost that connection to what people are driving to the track. It's been so long, and there's certainly efficiencies involved. These cars do get better fuel efficiency.
I was going to say,
they get 10 to 15%.
Yeah, environmental pressure?
Well, I think maybe a little bit. They you know, the green message of NASCAR is an important one, and these cars do get somewhere. It depends on the track. Actually, a carburetor, if you at a track like Daytona, where it'll be tuned more or less or set up to run within a fairly narrow RPM range, it's actually pretty efficient. The shorter the track, when you go to mile and a half, especially to mile and three quarters and the shorter tracks, the more you're on and off the throttle, the more efficient the fuel injection is, right? Where you used to see a lot of what we call off-throttle flame, right? A guy goes into the turn, he pops off the throttle. Well, guess what? That carburetor, there's a bunch of unburned fuel that's going to flow out, and you see that fire popping out of the tailpipe.
You got it.
Right?
You got it.
Now, we had fans going, you know, can you put the flame back? Can you give the driver a button to maybe pop some flame and, you know, do that? Especially at a good night race, you want to see a lot of that flame. Well, the reality is that's inefficiency. That's unburned fuel. That's not a good, you know, part of it. So to your point, yeah, I think there was certainly part of the green, and it is more efficient to the teams. That is another point when you think about how the race is operated. The teams, you know, this last year was such a big learning. They really didn't know, based on, you know, the 2011 season when you got to 12 of fuel injection, how's their fuel consumption going to be at these various tracks where they had a decade of history,
yeah,
and now all of a sudden you got a brand new system. Well, what kind of gas mileage or fuel efficiency you're going to get on that track? Don't know. You're going to have to learn. So,
fascinating. So one more quick question for you,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm going to let you go because I know that you've got to get moving for Daytona. But the Gen 6 cars, have you mm-hmm. had to make any modification whatsoever in the EFI for the new models?
No, that's a really good question. The reality is the engine platform, including EFI, has had very, very few changes. Very few changes. Most of the things that we see going on the EFI and engine computer side, I think, are just more incremental in the evolution of I'll call it the idiosyncrasies and inputs from the driver. How the driver, do they want, you know, there's always pluses and minuses, right? They can't have everything. Well, they you know, if they want a better throttle response in this area or if they want this kind of, you know, feel to it, those are things that they will continue to focus on. But the reality is the Gen 6 car, the computer, again, having this EFI unit in, when you think about starting in Daytona, right, because everybody's done the same amount of testing pretty much, and everybody kind of has what they have. When you get into the season, the computer, this is such a critical part as they get into Phoenix and Vegas and you get into the season, how they will use the information to tune and understand all the idiosyncrasies of that car. The reality is there's really not any changes from our standpoint. It's the same setups. It's right up on the dash. And it's more the driver's input. But when you talk to the crew chief, you talk to the teams, they know that information, the data that they get, is going to be even so much more important because, again, as we know, it's supposed to be exciting, and winning on the track is in little bitty pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this, again, if they were doing this, let me put it this way, if they were going to Gen 6 and didn't have this system, it would be a lot more difficult and complicated process for them.
So any crew that comes out this year and says, okay, well, wait a minute, it's the EFI, and it's the EFI with the Gen 6, they're just looking for excuses.
I like to think, exactly. I think, you know, as we know, it's aerodynamics, right? There's a lot
yeah.
of discussion about air cushion and drafting and all of the things. Hey,
yep.
200 miles an hour, it's all about, you know, I certainly haven't had fluid dynamics and mechanics since college, but I do understand enough that that's where the issue is, and I think getting different – I think what they don't know is as you get the different shapes of cars together on the track, how's it going to behave if you're drafting behind a Chevrolet versus a Toyota or a Ford? I think those are the dynamics that they're most interested in. They just don't know.
Yeah.
But we'll find out on Sunday.
Steve, I'm going to tell you, I could talk this stuff. I'm fascinated by the physics of it all. I could talk this stuff for the next 30 minutes. Jonathan would kill me, though, over here. So.
Hey, it's interesting stuff.
It really is fascinating. I thank you so much for being on with us and educating our listeners. We know that we've got a bunch of people out there right now who are probably tuning in, and they're hearing about NASCAR for the first time, and I think it really, really helps when we bring it down to you know, some real basics. And you've done a beautiful job with that, with a complicated situation, complicated issue. So
we appreciate
you being here with us.
And, you bet. I appreciate you guys giving me the time. Give me a call anytime.
Absolutely. Listen, you can bet I'm going to be on your phone if a car fails and we find out it was something related to your guys.
Yeah, if something happens, I'll probably have to just stay in Daytona. I won't be able to come back to Austin, but let's hope that doesn't happen.
Hey, listen, I'm very jealous of the fact, too, that you're heading down there. I wish I were going with you.
Hey, no rain. Not this year. No rain.
Oh, please. No rain. We don't want it to go to Monday night.
There we go.
All right, Chief.
All right, guys. Take care.
Thank you, Chief. Pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Interesting stuff, man. Really interesting.
I hate to sound like a techno geek or something, but boy, oh boy, I am fascinated by
that. You can just hear the giddiness in your voice
and I apologize, really, truly, because if there might be some out there that have their eyes glazed over right now. But I'm telling you, I just think the whole talk of it is just fascinating.
It is. It really is.
You know, I never once, Jonathan, ever took a physics class in my entire life. And yet, there's an awful lot about physics I understand. And when you're talking about race car driving, a lot of it is physics.
Yeah. Well, it all is. Absolutely. No doubt about it. We just want to thank Steve Nelson from Freescale Semiconductor for joining us again. And awesome job. Very interesting stuff to learn about. So. All right, man, let's swing it over real quick to Major League Baseball. We have a little over 20 minutes left in the show and a few more things to talk about here.
Yeah.
Mike, you sent me something a little bit ago. David Wright, starting third baseman from the New York Mets. Nice comments. And this is coming off of us having Kelly Stinnett on a couple of weeks ago, who made some real refreshing comments on the PED use in Major League Baseball, Mike.
These are the kinds of comments, Jonathan, that we right here at Fan Junkies just love.
Yeah, we love and we would hope to see more of and hear of, and here we go. David Wright, talking about the whole, PED stuff with the Miami Clinic and everything. He says, and I quote, "If you cheat, I hope you get caught. I don't care if you are with the same agency I'm with or not. If you are a cheater, I hope you get caught and I hope you get punished," end quote.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Absolutely beautiful.
Beautiful.
Listen, I've got a whole newfound respect for David Wright.
Yeah. Absolutely, especially with the whole report from last night coming out that a couple more players got caught being on that ACES client list, and that's Mets outfield prospect Anthony Puello, San Diego Padres pitcher Fortino De Los Santos, and Houston Astros outfielder Fernando Martinez, as well as Padres shortstop Everett Cabrera and Oakland A's receiver Jordan Arbertho, who were former ACES clients. So.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a trend going on here, Mike? I mean,
I know where you're going. Yeah,
yeah.
I know exactly where you're going there. I don't know. I mean, or is it just that it's a Miami-based clinic? You know what I mean?
Well, okay. Well, here's where I'm going, and I hope I don't insult anybody by
I know.
It's not mean to be insultful.
Yeah.
This is down in Miami. Miami is a very, very large Latin population.
Mm-hmm.
The minor leaguers who are coming over, they're in Florida. They're signing with these agencies that are letting these guys base themselves down in Florida because they'll be closer to their countries.
Mm-hmm.
So they can fly out of Florida instead. Now, if you look at the list of these prospects, the majority of them are Latin American.
Yes.
Now, my opinion is there something going on with these agents who sign these Latin American players, number one? Number two, is it easier for these people, like the ACES clinic down in Miami, is it easier for them to push this stuff towards people coming from other countries who are stuck in the minor leagues, hopefully, and telling them that, hey, this can give you an edge to get to the majors.
Right, right.
And the big bucks. That's my opinion, Mike.
I see
the trend coming.
Yeah, I hear you. And when you first insinuated what you did, I was hesitant because – I didn't want to be running the risk of giving it a taint of being some sort of stereotype. But what you're saying, there does seem to be some logical sense to it, at least in the framework of the way that you're painting it.
Yeah.
That's a possibility.
To me, it's a lot of these guys, they don't know any better. They grow up in the slums of some of these countries, and all they want to do is come here and be able to make money to send back to their parents, to their siblings, to their grandparents. And now you got these guys coming along saying, hey, listen, I think you should start taking this. This might give you an edge to have a bigger baseball career. These guys really don't know any of that stuff. You know what I mean? So that's where I think the trend is coming from.
Well, you know, I a lot of it's speculation. I'm not sure if I...
Well, yeah, of course it's speculation. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I hear you. I find it difficult to believe that even a minor leaguer, a double-A, a triple-A player wouldn't be aware of what the ramifications and the rules are in Major League Baseball.
You wonder. You know what? You wonder. You really have to wonder about that, Mike, because it just continues to happen. It just continues to happen, and these people are supposed to know the punishment. Are they just not afraid of the punishment?
Yeah. Well,
is this where we're going to have to start going with an entire Major League Baseball ban?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I find it difficult to believe that anybody who would be playing Major League Baseball, double A or triple A, wouldn't know what the regs are and what the rules are. I find it difficult to believe. And I don't care where you're coming from.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care what your language barrier might be. Somebody is going to be able to get through to you and say, hey, see that stuff over there? Stay the hell away from it.
Well, you think it would somebody would get through to them to tell them that, but are people actually telling them that?
Wow.
You know, to me, there's a bigger problem in Major League Baseball, and I think not only is MLB and the players a big part of it, but I also think that agencies and the people attached to these players coming into the minors are also a very, very big part of it, Mike. So
yeah. Well, now, you know, one of the things I just want to point out, and let me do this kind of as an aside, because I want to throw a shout out and a thank you to a mutual friend of ours, and that's Tanya Mercado, who had me on last night on her Five Tool show.
Yeah.
We talked a lot of National League East, and we talked particularly a lot of Mets baseball, believe it or not, Jonathan. I had to. I currently now know more about Mets baseball than I ever care to admit.
Is that archived so I can listen to you about Mets baseball?
Oh, wow. You got it. It is archived. Absolutely. You can go and listen to that. But we were talking a little bit about PED usage on the front end. One of the things that I just want to point out with regard to David Wright's comments here, take note, Wright felt compelled that he had to come out and make a statement because of an affiliation that his agent has with these other folks that are being accused of it coming from that Miami clinic.
Yeah.
Now, and I point that out because one of the conversations that we had last night on Tanya's show, on the Five Tools show, was we were talking about the, as you and I have talked about as well, the taint that occurs to other players when you get lumped into those groups.
Absolutely.
Like Piazza's. The Murphys, you know, name all the ones that didn't get into the Hall of Fame who should have gotten in, but, you know, because they were in that major group.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a shame that you've got somebody like David Wright. And you know, David Wright's got his detractors, I understand, but I, for one, have always felt he was a stand-up guy. I really like David Wright.
Yeah.
For David Wright to have to feel that he has to come out and make a public statement simply because of an affiliation he's got with his agent, I think is kind of a shame.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that Aces agency with his Seth and Sam Levinson runs, they lost a lot of notable players due to this, one of them being Shane Victorino from the Boston Red Sox, former Philadelphia Philly. They left as soon as they heard about the whole association with that Juan Carlos Nunez and that whole scheme that was being concocted down there. So.
Right.
It's a real shame, but I'm glad David Wright came out and said these comments. You know, it puts a little bit more of a positive light on him as well by doing that. And it's great to hear somebody of David Wright's stature coming out and saying this, Mike, because that's something that we spoke about when we had Kelly Stinnett on.
Agreed.
And we heard his refreshing and amazing comments that where are these players that are in the game now, these big players that, you know, nobody's saying anything.
Right.
So,
you know, when you consider for a moment, Kelly Stinnett's making those comments.
Yes.
He's safe. In some respects, he's safe because he's a retired player.
Yes.
Here's David Wright making comments. He's not a retired player. He's in the Major League Baseball Players Association right now, and he's making the statements outright, and he's forthright about it. And so in many respects, you have to take David Wright here and kind of put him in the same group with the Kelly Stinnett out there. But actually, David is actually being even braver because he's stating it as an active player.
Yeah, good for him. Listen, what are they going to do to him? What, the players that are still taking steroids and PEDs behind you know, their team's backs, what are they going to do? Are they going to say something? No, they're not going to say nothing. Are they going to treat David Wright like dirt? Maybe, but guess what? There's a lot of other guys that are on his ball club and in the league that don't take that stuff that are always going to have his back. So he don't care.
Right.
You know, and I'm glad he said something. But at the same time, now if David Wright made the comments that Kelly Stinnett made on our show, it would have been out everywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's one of the things that we always said, that what Kelly told us, that should have been out everywhere. We tried our best to get it out everywhere so people could hear it. And unfortunately, Kelly Stinnett wasn't a David Wright, so we couldn't get it out there.
Right. But, of course, as you and I both recognized and pointed out during Kelly Stinnett's conversations with us, while David Wright certainly will have people that will be watching his back, certainly, there is that fraternity amongst them all where whether they're doing it or not, there a lot of them are just going to keep their mouth shut. They're not going to say anything at all.
No, because they just want to play their ball. They want
exactly.
to make their money, and that's it. And then
exactly.
you don't want to get out of it. So
you know, just you know, so even the cleanest guys out there might be just going along, doing their job, and saying, you know, something. Those guys are doing it over there. I know about it, but you know something. It's not for me to say. I'm not making any comment about it. Let me just go do my thing.
Yeah.
David Wright at least has got the what's the word I want? Guts enough. I was going to use a different word. Guts enough to come out on a public stage and say it, and I think it's wonderful.
Hey, listen, it's his league. That's what he does. It's his business. It's his occupation. You know what? Every player has every right to say something about it. Unfortunately, David Wright is the only one that has the guts enough to say anything about it. So our kudos and, you know, our hats off to David Wright.
Absolutely.
All right, Mike, let's talk a little NBA quick. We have a little bit of about 13 minutes left in the show, so if anybody wants to call in, the number is 347-237-5373. Right now we're going to talk NBA because tomorrow is the trade deadline, Mike.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of rumors floating out there, and one of them is just got a rumor right here on my desk from Alex Kennedy, who's always on top of anything, saying that the New York Knicks either offered or are going to offer Amari Stoudemire and Amon Shumpert to Atlanta Hawks for Josh Smith.
Whoa.
A throw-in of somebody like a Zaza Pachulia, which will be under the cap and could be made. As soon as I read that, I said, wow, shocked.
Yeah, hold on, Jonathan. Let me run that by me again. Stoudemire and who?
Stoudemire and Amon Shumpert.
Okay.
The shooting guard, defensive specialist, would be offered to Atlanta for Josh Smith. I would love it. I would hate
really?
To lose Stoudemire, and I would hate to lose Shumpert for a couple of different reasons. But at the same time, you get a defensive present and a little bit of offense from Josh Smith. I think Josh Smith could be a nice piece of that puzzle for the Knicks to really compete and get far into the playoffs.
Well, really? You would be in favor of it?
Yes, I would be. I would be.
Wow. I'm a little bit surprised.
You know what? Not only – listen, Stoudemire is at the end of his rope. He's doing very good off the bench. Amon Shumpert's having some trouble coming back from that knee injury that he had last season. He doesn't look anything like the Amon Shumpert of last year. Can he come back next year? I'm sure he can. But at the same time, he's not getting a lot of minutes. Now you get Josh Smith. He's going to come in. He's going to play, and he's going to play a lot. You get a healthy Rasheed Wallace back. You get you get to use a couple other players off the bench now. I like the deal. If it happens, I'm not saying it's going to happen. Right now it's just a rumor, but it's something that I think it's really worth looking into for the New York Knicks. But I like what the Knicks are doing right now. I like what Glenn Grunwald is doing. He's looking at every possible deal right now instead of focusing on just saying, oh, well, maybe we could just sign Kenyon Martin off the scrap heap, have him on a bench, and that's it. We're good for the year. He's trying to look to see, hey, listen, we have a good team here. We have a really good base. We have a lot of good players. Can we get to the finals? Can we really win it this year? And I think by exploring a deal like that, it really shows that Glenn Grunwald believes that the Knicks could make it to the finals.
Okay, but let me ask you two questions with regard to this, and you're the Knicks guy, and I'm asking them to you as a hometown fan there. First question.
Shoot.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, why mess with what you've got? You've got the second best record right now in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, they're floating right now, Mike. They're floating. They're only two games up in first. They haven't been playing good as of late. a lot of guys are starting to fall back. Jason Kidd, you know, he was a big part of that hot start. He's been, you know, plain and simple, awful a lot of games now. Rasheed Wallace going out was a huge, huge void, which I never thought I would be saying today, considering we spoke a lot about the Knicks signing Rasheed Wallace before he was even signed during the offseason. Marcus Camby being out, Kurt Thomas not getting any minutes, Pablo Prigioni. They got a lot of age on the bench, and now, like we said, it would probably start catching up to them towards the middle and towards the end of the season. It's starting to hit them now.
Okay, you're confirming then what I kind of suspected early on in the season. I think I even brought it up here on the show.
You did,
And that is that we are now past the midseason point.
Yes.
And the age is starting to become a factor.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know what? We can't throw Amari in it because Amari's been playing great, great basketball off the bench. He's been playing great, great basketball off the bench. But if you can get some guys that can complement Amari and Tyson Chandler in the starting lineup, you have to go for it, Mike. You know?
Okay, now let me ask you real quick about that trade.
So if they can get a throw in like a Zaza Pachulia, it could help them. It could propel them. So
okay, let me ask you real quick about that trade, and then we'll move on. But let me ask you about the trade. If it were to go exactly that way, is that a fair trade?
You know what? In the end, it really depends. I would take Josh Smith over Amari right now. Amon Shumpert is the thing I think that the Knicks would really, really miss. Because if he gets back to where he was last season, that is a key to the cog that you're always going to miss. Mm-hmm. Is it going to happen that way? I hope not. You know, I hope somehow, some way that they can keep Amon Shumpert. But in the end, I mean, we've heard that he was rumored to go to Orlando for J.J. Redick. Now we're hearing that he's rumored to go here. We also heard that he was rumored to go to the Phoenix Suns for Jared Dudley.
Right.
So there's got to be a reason why Glenn Grunwald is pushing it. Amon Shumpert's agent came out today saying that they didn't ask for a trade. Mike Woodson assured Amon Shumpert that he wasn't going to be traded. Now is this Glenn Grunwald just doing his due diligence because it is the trade deadline to see what he can get? I mean, if somebody's going to, you know, blow him over to get Amon Shumpert, he's going to take it.
Uh-huh.
You know, you have to put those players out there to see if somebody is going to do that and try to pay too much for Amon Shumpert and the Knicks become a winner. So, tough to say, Mike. You know, right now it's just rumors. There's a lot of rumors out there. We also heard Celtics putting Rajon Rondo on a trade block. Now we're hearing that his agent saying that he's not going to be traded and that he won't be traded. With Josh Smith, we heard that the Bucks and the Nets are in on that as well. Just a lot of rumors out there, Mike. When we look at it from the standpoint, Eric Bledsoe from the Clippers, backup point guard there, not sure why they would want to trade him because with Chris Paul being out, before he was out, Eric Bledsoe was a big part of the Los Angeles Clippers.
Uh-huh.
Al Jefferson and Paul Millsap in Utah, they're also back on the trade block again as they normally are. Would be huge for somebody to pick up either one of those two guys. Dwight Howard, though. Will the Lakers trade him? Will they not trade him?
Right.
That's something that we've been hearing a lot about, Mike. So, last thing I heard, Lakers aren't trading him. So,
okay.
Now, if he leaves in the offseason, because it looks like he is definitely not going to return to the Lakers in the offseason, does not want to be there. Now, where did it go from here? They gave away, I'm not going to say they gave away a lot, Mike, but they gave away some big players in order to get Dwight Howard.
Mm-hmm.
So, we have to see what would happen there. So, and we have a lot of great comments in the room here from H2O Willie. Amari is guaranteed way too much money for the player he is right now. I guarantee that is a great comment. It's true. He is guaranteed way too much money for the player he is. He is a bench player. He's been a very effective player off the bench for the Knicks, but being paid a lot. If they can somehow get rid of Amari Stoudemire and bring somebody in here that's younger, that can play more effective basketball, I guarantee you Grunwald will do that for the Knicks, Mike. So,
well, I'm going to be honest with you. You're bringing it up to me for the first time here today, and obviously it's breaking news coming over to you. As you were announcing it, it takes me a bit by surprise. I'll be honest.
Oh no, absolutely. Listen, it took me by surprise too because there was no talks about this at all, and now we got this big blockbuster trade here. You know, where you would see somebody of a Stoudemire and an Amon Shumpert going to Atlanta for a Josh Smith and somebody like Zaza Pachulia who could make the cap work. Would that be the final deal if it happens? Probably not. I think you'd see a lot more players thrown in the mix there. But at the same time, in the end, I don't see that kind of a deal happening, Mike. So,
okay.
You know, that's my opinion, but great job by Alex Kennedy over at Hoops World. One of the most phenomenal guys out there on the NBA beat. So if anything, follow him on Twitter, at AlexKennedyNBA, and you can stay up with everything. I know that the Knicks do want to bring in another guard, though, Mike. They've looked at Jared Dudley. They've looked at J.J. Redick, and we know that they've had an infatuation with Luke Ridenour, who's with the Minnesota Timberwolves now for quite a few years. Will the Knicks make a trade? I don't think they will, Mike.
If they do,
it's going to be to grab somebody like a Luke Ridenour. So.
I'm glad you answered that question because I was going to throw it at you. Barring that, let's say this doesn't go through, you're already indicating, you know, hey, the age thing is starting to catch up here. Perhaps maybe they do need to do something. I, for one, am more conservative. I say if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Leave it alone. You're saying, and I was going to throw it at you, but you're saying it. You don't actually think they will make a move, huh?
No. I think they're going to make a move. Will it be a trade or will it be a free agent signing? That's the difference maker right now. I honestly believe that if they don't make a move, that they will sign Kenyon Martin. Mm-hmm. He does want to come back to the NBA. He does want to play, and he does want to be reunited with Carmelo Anthony and J.R. Smith, who he played with in Denver.
Okay.
I think that would be a very good move, bringing in Kenyon Martin. He showed he was very effective last year, and I believe he could be effective now for just the second half of basketball in the playoffs. They need that defense, and they need that kind of body because they're not getting it from guys like Kurt Thomas, Chris Copeland, and Marcus Camby right now. So I think that would be the best bet. And if they do make a deal, I think it would be for a backup point guard like a Luke Ridenour. That's something they're really hurting for on the bench right now because Jason Kidd just has not been good and, showing his age right now. So
is Martin in shape?
From what I'm hearing, yes, Martin is in shape, and he definitely wants to come back in and play. And from what we saw from Kenyon Martin last year when supposedly he wasn't in shape, he showed right away after about a couple of games that he was ready to play basketball. So
that's what always worries me when you bring a guy in off the bench. I mean, literally off the bench, the sofa bench, and you put him in the second half of the season.
Absolutely. We have H2O Willie in the room right now saying, you know what, make an interesting trade. Trade Amari Stoudemire for Emeka Okafor, who's playing for the Washington Wizards.
That's an interesting idea.
Maybe not, but Emeka Okafor was starting and still only averaging 9 points a game. So that's a guy I just wouldn't touch, especially with his cap hit as well. I believe he has an extra year on his deal than Amari. Not entirely sure about that, but from what I can get from covering the deadlines last year, I believe he does have one more year left. But interesting trade if they do. He could be an interesting bench player. So
Okafor's name's been thrown around for the Sixers as well.
Yeah, Okafor is always going to be thrown around. So always a guy that wants to get rid of.
Oh, gosh.
That's what you know. All right, Mike. 2 minutes left.
Yep.
To the show here, we want to thank Steve Nelson from Freescale Semiconductor for joining us today for our NASCAR week. We want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening to Fan Junkies Radio. It's always a privilege and an honor to bring the show to you 3 times a week. Without you, we're nothing here. So
Friday, we got a big show Friday.
Friday, we got a big show. Lauren Bush from Lauren Bush Racing will be joining us. Teen phenom, 19 years old, trying to break into NASCAR, hopefully one day, and with Danica Patrick winning this past weekend. That's got to be huge for females in the sport of racing, especially for the young women trying to get in and make a really big name for themselves. So we'll talk to Lauren Bush about that, her future in racing, and also, of a male-dominated sport for so many years.
Yeah, her dad will be joining us as well, Joe.
Yeah, so we can definitely get the aspect of a parent and a girl breaking into racing. It would be nice to hear about that from them. So join us on Friday for that, for the end of NASCAR week here on Fan Junkies Radio. As always, frathousesports.net. Check out our own Frat House Mike and Sidekick over there. And as always, fanjunkies.net. Join up, sign up. It's free. We have a blast over there. It's social network. It's a like page. But it's specifically for sports fans. We got some great, great guests coming on. And we had some even better news coming real soon. We're working on a lot of things here on Fan Junkies Radio. And like we said, it's because of you that we get to do all of this. And we get to meet and we get to greet so many wonderful people in the land of sports. Once again, thanks for tuning in. And for Mike McShane, I'm Jonathan Ragus. And we'll see you all for Friday as we welcome Lauren Bush from Lauren Bush Racing. Thank you again.
Catch you then.